Antiquities, Book 18. How Quirinius was sent by Caesar as assessor of Syria and Judea, and to dispose of Archelaus's estate. How Coponius of the Equestrian Order was sent as prefect of Judea. How Judas the Galilean persuaded the people not to register their property, until Josar the high priest persuaded them instead to submit to the Romans. What sects there were among the Jewish philosophers, and how many, and what their laws were. How Herod and Philip the Tetrarchs founded cities in honor of Caesar. How the Samaritans defiled the people for 7 days by scattering the bones of the dead in the temple. How Salome, the sister of Herod, on her death left her estate to Julia, the wife of Caesar. How Pontius Pilate wished to bring the busts of Caesar secretly into Jerusalem, and the people rioted and would not accept it. What happened to the Jews in Rome at this time because of the Samaritans? The accusation brought against Pilate by the Samaritans before Vitellius, and how Vitellius forced him to go up to Rome to answer for his conduct. The war of Herod the Tetrarch against Aretas, king of the Arabs, and his defeat. How Tiberius Caesar wrote to Vitellius to persuade Artabanus the Parthian to send him hostages and to make war on Aretas. The death of Philip, and how his tetrarchy became a province. The voyage of Agrippa to Rome, and how, accused by his own freedman, he was put in chains. How he was released by Gaius after the death of Tiberius and became king of Philip's tetrarchy. How Herod, having gone up to Rome, was exiled, and how Gaius gave his tetrarchy to Agrippa. The strife between the Jews and Greeks in Alexandria and the embassy sent by each side to Gaius. The accusation of the Jews by Appian and his fellow envoys on the ground that they had no statue of Caesar. The disaster that befell the Jews in Babylon because of the brothers Asinius and Anileus. This book covers a period of 32 years. Quirinius, a man of senatorial rank who had held the other offices of state and passed through all of them on his way to the consulship, a man great in other respects too in his standing, arrived in Syria with a small retinue, sent out by Caesar to be judge of the nation and to assess its properties. Coponius of the Equestrian Order was sent with him to hold full authority over the Jews. Quirinius also came into Judea, now added to Syria as an appendage, to assess their properties and dispose of Archelaus's money. The Jews, though at first indignant at the very idea of the census, gave way and did not resist any further, persuaded by the high priest Josar, son of Bothus. Submitting to Josar's arguments, they assessed their properties without further hesitation. But Judas, a Galilean from a city called Gamala, taking with him Sadoc, a Pharisee, pressed hard for revolt, saying that the assessment meant nothing less than outright slavery, and calling on the nation to defend its freedom. If they succeeded, he said, they would win prosperity for the possession they had gained. And if they failed of that good, they would still win honor and glory for their high resolve. And God himself would join eagerly in bringing their plans to success, if only they, setting their hearts on great things, did not shrink from the labor it required. And since the people received their words with such pleasure, the enterprise made great headway. There is no evil that did not spring from these two men and fill the nation to overflowing, beyond all telling. Wars brought on by their teaching, which knew no cessation of violence. The loss of friends who might have lightened the burden, the raids of great bands of brigands, the murder of leading men, under the pretense of the public good, but in reality from hope of private gain. The factions that grew out of this and political bloodshed, some of it inflicted by men slaughtering their own kinsmen in a madness that would not let them fall short of their rivals, some by the hand of the enemy. Famine reduced at last to the extremity of shamelessness, the storming and razing of cities, until this same faction spread even to burning the very temple of God with the fire of our enemies. So true is it that the innovation and alteration of ancestral ways carries great weight toward the ruin of those who combine to bring it about, since Judas and Sadoc, by raising up among us a fourth philosophy never known before, and finding no shortage of enthusiasts for it, filled the state at once with turmoil and planted the roots of the troubles that followed, all through a philosophy till then unfamiliar to us. About this I wish to say a little, especially since the passion of the younger generation for it coincided with the ruin of our affairs. The Jews had, from the most ancient of their traditions, three philosophies: that of the Essenes, that of the Sadducees, and a third followed by those called Pharisees. I have already spoken of these in the second book of the Jewish War, but I will nonetheless recall them briefly again now. The Pharisees make their way of life simple, conceding nothing to soft living, and they follow the guidance of whatever their reason tradition has judged and handed down as good, holding that the observance of its precepts is a thing worth fighting for. They yield honor to their elders, and those who are puffed up with boldness do not presume to contradict what their elders have proposed. Holding that all things are brought about by fate, they nonetheless do not strip from human beings the will to act on their own impulse, since it has pleased God that there should be a mingling, and that the will of man, with its virtue or its vice, should join in the deliberation of fate's counsel. They believe that souls have an immortal power, and that beneath the earth there are rewards and punishments for those whose practice of virtue or vice has occurred in life, perpetual imprisonment for the latter, but for the former an easy path back to life. Because of these beliefs, they are extremely persuasive with the common people, and whatever is done in the way of divine worship, prayers, and the performance of sacrifices is carried out under their direction. To such a degree have the cities borne witness to their virtue, by their pursuit of what is best in all things, both in their manner of life and in their speech. The Sadducees, on the other hand, hold that the soul perishes along with the body, and they own no observance at all beyond the laws. Indeed, they count it a virtue to dispute with the teachers of the school of wisdom that they follow. This doctrine has reached only a few men, though these are the foremost in rank, and practically nothing is ever accomplished by them, for whenever they come to office, they submit, unwillingly and under compulsion, to what the Pharisee says, since otherwise the populace would not tolerate them. Among the Essenes, the tradition is to leave everything in God's hands, but they too hold the soul immortal, counting the attainment of what is just a thing worth contending for. They send offerings to the temple, but perform their sacrifices according to a purity distinct from that of others, by which they are kept apart from the common precinct, and so offer their sacrifices among themselves. Otherwise, they are men of the best character, wholly devoted to farming. What deserves admiration in them above all others who lay claim to virtue is a practice found among no Greeks or barbarians, indeed not even briefly, one that has been with them from ancient times without interruption. Their property is held in common, and the rich man enjoys no more of his own wealth than the man who possesses nothing at all. Those who follow this way of life number more than 4,000. They take no wives and have no desire to own slaves, believing the latter leads to injustice and the former opens the way to strife. Instead, living by themselves, they render service to one another. They elect collectors of their revenues, good men chosen from among whatever the land produces, and priests to prepare bread and other food. They live in no way differently from most others, except that they most closely resemble the customs of the Dacians. Of the fourth of the philosophies, Judas the Galilean set himself up as leader. In everything else, it agrees with the opinion of the Pharisees, but they have an unconquerable passion for freedom, since they hold that God alone is their leader and master. They think little of enduring the strangest forms of death, or the punishment of kinsmen and friends, for the sake of never calling any man master. Since most people have seen for themselves how unshakable they are in holding to this position, I have let the matter drop without going further into it, for I have no fear that anything said about them might be met with disbelief. Rather, my fear is that my account might fall short of the contempt with which they actually receive suffering and pain. It was from this madness that the nation began to sicken, when Gessius Florus, who was then governor, drove them by his abuse of power to desperation and revolt from Rome. So much for the philosophical schools among the Jews. Quirinius, having now sold off Archelaus's property and the assessments, which took place in the 37th year after Caesar's defeat of Antony at Actium, now complete, deposed Josar the high priest, who had lost the confidence of the populace, and appointed Ananus, son of Seth, high priest in his place. Herod and Philip, each having received his own tetrarchy, settled into their rule. Herod fortified Sepphoris to be the ornament of all Galilee, and named it Autocratorus, and Bethrampha, likewise a city, he surrounded with a wall and named Julia's, after the emperor's wife. Philip built up Paneas by the springs of the Jordan and named it Caesarea. And the village of Bethsaida on the lake of Genesaret, he raised to the rank of a city, both by the size of its population and by other means, and named it Julia's after the emperor's daughter. While Coponius, whom I said had been sent out along with Quirinius, was governing Judea, the following took place. During the feast of unleavened bread, which we call Passover, it was the custom for the priests to open the gates of the temple from the middle of the night. So on that occasion, as soon as the gates were first opened, some Samaritans, who had come secretly into Jerusalem, began scattering human bones about the porticos and throughout the whole temple, an act unheard of before then. Because of this, the priests kept the temple under still stricter guard than before. Not long after, Coponius returned to Rome, and Marcus Ambivulus arrived to succeed him in office. Under his term, Salome, the sister of King Herod, died, leaving to Julia the town of Jamnia and its whole toparchy, together with Phasaelis and Archelae in the plain, where the plantations of palm trees are most abundant and their fruit is excellent. Annius Rufus succeeded him in turn, and it was under his term that Caesar died, having been the second man to rule Rome as emperor for 57 years, 6 months, and more than 2 days, of which time Antony shared rule with him for 14 years. He lived to the age of 77. Tiberius Nero, the son of Caesar's wife Julia, succeeded him in the principate, being now the third emperor, and it was he who sent Valerius Gratus to the Jews as prefect, in succession to Annius Rufus. Gratus, having removed Ananus from the priesthood, declared Ismael, son of Fabi, high priest, and not long after removing him too, he appointed Eleazar, son of the high priest Ananus, high priest. A year having passed, he removed this man as well and handed the high priesthood over to Simon, son of Camithus. This man too held the office no more than a year before Gratus removed him, and Joseph, also called Caiaphas, succeeded him. Having done all this, Gratus returned to Rome after spending 11 years in Judea. Pontius Pilate came to succeed him. Herod the Tetrarch, who had by now advanced far in Tiberius's friendship, built a city named Tiberias after him, settling it with the best people of Galilee on the lake of Genesaret. There are hot springs not far off in a village called Amathus. Settlers of mixed origin flocked there, no small number of them Galileans. And there were those brought from the territory under his rule by compulsion and force to inhabit the place, and some, too, of the ruling class. He took in as fellow settlers even destitute men gathered from every quarter, some of them not even certainly free, and in many ways he freed and benefited them, imposing on them the obligation not to abandon the city. For their houses he built at his own expense, and he made them a grant of land, knowing that the settlement was contrary to the law and to Jewish tradition, since many tombs had to be removed to make room for the founding of Tiberias, and our law declares that those who dwell on such a site are unclean for 7 days. About this same time, Phraates, king of the Parthians, died, the victim of a plot laid against him by his son Phraates, for the following reason. Phraates, having had legitimate children, had also an Italian slave girl named Thermusa, sent to him among other gifts by Caesar. He made use of her at first as a concubine, but, struck by her great beauty as time went on, and once she had borne him a son, Phraates, he made her his lawful wife and held her in honor. Having, in everything she might say, gained the king's confidence, and eager that the rule of the Parthians should pass to her own son, she saw that this could not come about unless the legitimate sons of Phraates were somehow removed. She therefore persuaded him to send his legitimate sons to Rome as hostages. And since it was not easy for anyone to oppose Thermusa's commands to Phraates, these sons were duly sent off to Rome. Phraates, now being raised alone to share in the government, thought it a hard thing, and at the same time a long wait for his father to hand over the rule to him in due course. And so he plotted against his father, with the collusion of his mother, with whom, rumor had it, he was also intimate. Hated on both these accounts, his subjects reckoning his mother's incestuous love no less monstrous a pollution than the murder of his father. He was driven out by a rebellion before he could grow great in power, and fell from his position, and so died. The noblest of the Parthians, taking counsel together, since it was impossible for a people to be governed without a king, and yet it was not lawful for anyone but one of the royal line of the Arsacids to rule, and it was intolerable for the royal dignity to go on being insulted in this way, as had already happened many times even down to now, from by an Italian concubine's marriage and their offspring they called him Orodes. Sending envoys to fetch him, a man otherwise resented by the populace and open to blame for the extremity of his cruelty, for he was thoroughly perverse and quick to violent anger, but he was one of the royal line. Him they conspired together and killed, some say at a truce and at table, since it was the custom for all to carry daggers, but as the more common account has it, they lured him out to a hunt. They then sent envoys to Rome asking for a king from among the hostages there, and Vonans was dispatched, chosen ahead of his brothers. For it seemed that fortune was inclining toward him, since two of the greatest realms under the sun, his own and a foreign one, were being offered to him. But barbarians are quick to overturn what they have set up, being by nature prone to instability, and disposed to resent any indignity, for they thought it beneath them to do the bidding of a king reared as another people's slave, calling his time as a hostage, slavery, instead, and holding the very title in contempt. It could not be, they said, that the man who would rule Parthia should have been handed over by right of war, and, worse still by far, by the insolence of peace. At once they summoned Artabanus, king of Media and himself of the Arsacid line. Artabanus was persuaded and advanced with an army. Vonans went out to meet him, and at first, with the mass of the Parthians rallying to his side, he drew up his forces and won, and Artabanus fled to the borders of Media. But not long after, gathering his strength again, Artabanus engaged Vonans and won, and Vonans rode off to Seleucia with the few men around him. Artabanus, having wrought great slaughter in the rout to strike terror into the barbarians, withdrew to see Ctesiphon with his forces and was now king of the Parthians. Vonans fled into Armenia, and at first he set his hopes on that country and sent envoys to the Romans. But when Tiberius rejected him, both for his want of manly resolve and because of the threats of the Parthian king who was renewing his embassies with threats of war, there being no other way to secure a second kingdom, since the powerful men around Niphates in Armenia were now going over to Artabanus, Vonans gave himself up to Silenus, the governor of Syria. Silenus, out of respect for his rank, kept him under guard in Syria, while Artabanus gave Armenia to Orodes, one of his own sons. About this time Antiochus, king of Comagene, also died, and his people split into two factions over the notable men of the country, embassies coming from each side. The powerful wished to change the form of government into a province, while the common people wished to be ruled as a kingdom, according to their ancestral custom. The Senate voted to send Germanicus to set affairs in the east in order, fortune arranging for him the opportunity of his death. For once he had come to the east and set everything right, he was killed by poison at the hand of Piso, as has been related elsewhere. Pilate, the governor of Judea, brought an army from Caesarea and stationed it in winter quarters at Jerusalem, with the intention of abolishing the laws of the Jews. He introduced into the city the busts of Caesar that were mounted on the military standards, though our law forbids the making of images. For this reason, the earlier governors had always entered the city with standards that carried no such ornament. Pilate was the first to set up the images, bringing them into Jerusalem, and this he did without the people's knowledge, because it was done by night. When they learned of it, they came in crowds to Caesarea and pleaded with him for many days to have the images removed. He would not yield, since to do so seemed to him an affront to Caesar. But as they would not give up their entreaty, on the sixth day, he secretly stationed his soldiers under arms around the stadium where he held audience and came out himself to his tribunal. The stadium had been arranged so as to conceal the waiting troops. When the Jews again pressed their petition, at a given signal he had the soldiers surround them and threatened to inflict death upon them at once if they did not stop their clamor and go home. But they threw themselves face down on the ground, bared their throats, and declared they would gladly accept death rather than dare to transgress the wisdom of their laws. Pilate, astonished at the firmness of their devotion to the laws, at once had the images carried back from Jerusalem to Caesarea. Pilate also brought a supply of water into Jerusalem, at the expense of the sacred funds, by drawing off the source of the stream from a distance of some 200 stadia. The people were displeased at what was being done regarding the water, and many tens of thousands of them gathered and cried out against him, demanding that he stop the work he was so intent upon. Some also used abuse and heaped insults on the man, as a crowd is apt to do. He, however, had dressed a large number of soldiers in the Jews' own clothing, arming them with clubs concealed beneath their garments, and sent them out to surround the people. He then ordered the crowd itself to disperse. When they turned to hurling abuse, he gave his soldiers the signal that had been agreed upon beforehand. They set upon them with blows far heavier than Pilate had ordered, striking without distinction those who were rioting and those who were not. And the people, bringing nothing to defend themselves, were caught unarmed by men who had come prepared, so that many of them died on the spot from this, and others withdrew wounded. And so the uprising came to an end. About this time there lived Jesus, a wise man, if indeed one ought to call him a man, for he was a doer of astonishing deeds, a teacher of people who received the truth with pleasure, and he won over many Jews and many of the Greeks as well. He was the Christ. And when, on the indictment of the leading men among us, Pilate had condemned him to the cross, those who had loved him from the first did not cease to do so. For he appeared to them on the third day, alive again, the divine prophets having foretold this and countless other marvels about him. And to this day the tribe of the Christians, so named after him, has not disappeared. About the same time, another terrible thing threw the Jews into an uproar, and events took place concerning the temple of Isis at Rome that were not free from disgraceful conduct. Having first made mention of the crime committed regarding the rites of Isis, I will then turn my account to what happened among the Jews. Paulina was a woman of Rome, of ancestry no less distinguished for its rank than for the discipline of virtue she practiced beyond others of her time. Her name stood high, she had great wealth, and she was, moreover, beautiful in form, and at that age of life in which women take the greatest pride, while her whole manner of living was devoted to modesty. She was married to Saturninus, a man in every way to be compared with her for his own standing. Decius Mundus, a man of great rank among the knights of that day, fell in love with her, and since her greater worth made her not to be won by gifts, for even when he had sent presents amounting to a great sum, he saw them disregarded, and this only inflamed him the more he went so far as to promise 200,000 Attic drachmas for a single night with her. And when even this failed to bend her, unable to bear the misfortune of his passion, he judged it best to end his life by starving himself, to put a stop to the evil that had seized him, and he had resolved on death of this kind and was proceeding to carry it out. Now Mundus had a freedwoman of his father's, named Ide, versed in every kind of wickedness, who was deeply distressed at the young man's decision to die, for it was no secret that he would perish, and she went to him and roused him with her words, holding out the promise of certain hopes, namely that meetings with Paulina could be arranged for him. He received her plea with delight, and she told him that she would need only 50,000 for the winning over of the woman. Having thus revived the young man's spirits and taken the money he asked for, she did not proceed by the same means as those who had served him before, since she saw that the woman could not be won by money at all. But knowing that she was deeply devoted to the worship of Isis, she devised the following scheme. She went to certain of the priests, and with great assurances, and above all with a gift of money, 2.5 myriads at once, and as much again should the affair succeed, she revealed to them the young man's passion, urging them by every means to see that the woman was won for the one who would have her. They, led on by the prospect of the gold, promised their help. And the eldest of them, having pressed his way in to see Paulina once he had gained admittance, asked to speak with her alone. When this was granted, he told her he had come sent by Anubis, who, overcome by love of her, bade her come to him. This message was welcome to her, and she boasted to her friends of being thus honored by the claim of Anubis, and told her husband that a dinner and a night with Anubis had been announced to her. He consented, knowing well his wife's virtue. So she went to the temple, and after dining, when it was time for sleep, the doors were shut by the priest, the lamps within the shrine were put out, and Mundus, who had hidden himself there beforehand, did not fail to have intercourse with her, and served her the whole night through, she supposing him to be the god. And when he had departed, before the priests who knew of the plot had begun to stir, Paulina went early to her husband and told him of the epiphany of Anubis, and boasted of it in glowing words to her friends. They, looking at the nature of the thing, disbelieved it in part, while in part they were struck with wonder, not knowing how they could judge it incredible, when they considered her modesty and her rank. On the third day after the deed, Mundus met her and said, "Paulina, you have saved me 200,000 drachmas, though you might have added that sum to your own house, and yet you did not fail to render the service for which I first solicited you. As for the insult you sought to inflict on Mundus, I care nothing for names, but only for the pleasure got from the affair I gave myself the name of Anubis." With these words he departed, and she, coming only then to understand the enormity of what had been done to her, tore her garment, and, telling her husband the full extent of the whole plot, begged him not to overlook it, but to see that she got redress. He reported the affair to the emperor. Tiberius, once he had made careful inquiry, examined the priests under torture, crucified them along with Ide, who had caused the ruin and had contrived the whole scheme to the woman's dishonor, tore down the temple, and ordered the statue of Isis thrown into the Tiber River. Mundus he punished only with exile, judging that his offense, having been committed out of passion, was reason enough not to punish him more severely. Such were the outrages committed against the priests in connection with the temple of Isis. I return now to the account of what befell the Jews at Rome at this same time, as my narrative had already indicated it would. There was a Jewish man, a fugitive from his own country on a charge of transgressing certain laws, and from fear of the punishment due for them, thoroughly wicked in every way. At that time, living in Rome, he professed to expound the wisdom of the laws of Moses, and having gained 3 men wholly like himself in every respect, when Fulvia, a woman of high rank who had come over to the Jewish observances, began to frequent them, they persuaded her to send purple and gold to the temple in Jerusalem. And having received these, they used them for their own expenses, which had been the very purpose for which the request was made in the first place. Tiberius for Saturninus, a friend of his and Fulvia's husband, informed him of it at his wife's urging, ordered the whole Jewish population expelled from Rome. The consuls conscripted 4,000 of them into the army and sent them to Sardinia, the island, while they punished many more who refused military service out of regard for their ancestral laws. So it was that because of the wickedness of 4 men, the Jews were driven out of the city. Nor was the nation of the Samaritans free of disturbance. A man stirred them up who made light of falsehood and, to please the crowd, contrived every kind of scheme, calling on them to gather with him on Mount Gerizim, which they hold to be the most sacred of mountains, and he assured those who came that he would show them the sacred vessels buried there, which Moses had deposited in that very place. They believed the story plausible and came armed, and encamping in a certain village called Turathana, they took in those who kept joining them, intending to make the ascent of the mountain with a great multitude. But Pilate got ahead of their ascent by occupying the position beforehand with a column of cavalry and infantry, who engaged those who had already assembled in the village. In the battle that followed, some they killed, others they put to flight, and many they took captive alive, of whom Pilate put to death the ringleaders and the most influential among those who had fled. When the disturbance had been put down, the council of the Samaritans went to Vitellius, a man of consular rank who held the governorship of Syria, and accused Pilate of the slaughter of those who had died. For they said they had come to Turathana not to revolt from Rome, but to escape the outrage of Pilate. Vitellius sent Marcellus, one of his friends, to take charge of affairs for the Jews, and ordered Pilate to go to Rome to answer to the emperor for the charges the Samaritans were bringing. So Pilate, after spending 10 years in Judea, hastened to Rome, obeying the orders of Vitellius, which he could not refuse. But before he could reach Rome, Tiberius had already passed away. Vitellius, coming to Judea, went up to Jerusalem, and since it was their ancestral feast, called Passover, Vitellius was received with great magnificence. He remitted the taxes on the produce that was bought and sold for all the inhabitants of the region, and he also granted that the vestments of the high priest, together with all his adornment, which was kept in the temple, should remain in the charge of the priests, just as had been their right before. At that time it was kept in the Antonia, as the fortress there is called, its deposit there having come about for the following reason. One of the priests, Hyacinus, there having been many who bore that name, this being the first once he had built a residence close to the temple, spent most of his time there, and kept the vestments with him. For he was its guardian, since he alone had been granted the right to wear it. There he kept it stored away, and whenever he went down into the city he would resume his ordinary dress. And his sons practiced the same custom, as did their children after them. But when Herod became king, he took over that residence this vestment, finding it conveniently placed. Herod had rebuilt at great expense, and named Antonia, in honor of his friendship with Antony, and he kept the robe stored there just as he had received it, confident that the people would attempt no revolution against him because of it. Archelaus, the king who succeeded him, his son, did the same, and after him the Romans, once they had taken over the government, kept the high priest's robe stored in a stone chamber, sealed by the priests and the treasurers, while the captain of the guard lit a lamp there every day. 7 days before a festival, it was handed over to them by the captain of the guard, and after the high priest had used it in the purification rite, on the day following the festival, he put it away again in the chamber where it had lain before. This was done at each of the three festivals every year, and also at the fast. Vitellius, however, out of regard for our ancestral custom, made the robe available, instructing the captain of the guard not to concern himself with where it lay or when it might be needed. Having done this as a benefit to the nation, he also removed the high priest Joseph, called Caiaphas, from the priesthood and appointed Jonathan, son of Ananus the high priest, in his place. He then set out again for Antioch. Tiberius also sent a letter to Vitellius ordering him to make friendship with Artabanus, king of the Parthians, for Artabanus, being hostile and having seized Armenia, alarmed him, and he feared he might do further harm. Tiberius said he could trust in the friendship only if hostages were given him, above all the son of Artabanus. Writing this to Vitellius, Tiberius also persuaded, with large gifts of money, the king of the Iberians and the king of the Albanians not to hesitate to make war on Artabanus. They themselves held back, but the Alani, granting the Iberians and Albanians passage through their territory and opening the Caspian gates, brought them in against Artabanus. Armenia was seized from him again, and as the land of the Parthians was filled with wars, the foremost of the men there were killed, and everything was thrown into ruin for them, and the king's own son fell in these battles along with many tens of thousands of the army. Vitellius, by a lavish distribution of money to the king's relatives and friends, was on the point of having Artabanus himself killed through those who had taken the bribes. But Artabanus, perceiving the plot, and recognizing that it could not be escaped since it had been formed by many, including the foremost men, and that it would not be dropped until it was carried through, and believing that even those who still seemed to stand by him faithfully were either already corrupted and only feigning goodwill through deceit, or would go over to the rebels once tested, saved himself by fleeing to one of the upper satrapies. After this, he gathered a large army of the Dahi and the Sacchi, made war on those who opposed him, and recovered his kingdom. When Tiberius heard this, he desired that friendship be made with Artabanus after all, and since Artabanus too, when invited, gladly accepted the proposal concerning it, Artabanus and Vitellius came to the Euphrates. A bridge was thrown across the river, and each met the other at its very center, each with his own guard. When words of agreement had passed between them, Herod the Tetrarch entertained them, having had a costly pavilion set up in the middle of the crossing. Artabanus then sent Tiberius his son Darius as a hostage, along with many gifts, among them a man 7 cubits tall, a Jew by birth named Eleazar, who because of his size was called the giant. After this, Vitellius went off to Antioch and Artabanus to Babylonia. Herod, wishing to be the first to bring word to Caesar of the receiving of the hostages, sent off couriers, having written everything precisely in a letter, leaving nothing out for the consul to report. But when letters arrived from Vitellius as well, and Caesar signified to him that word of the matter had already reached him earlier, since Herod had sent notice of it first, Vitellius was greatly disturbed, and, supposing he had suffered a greater slight than had actually been done to him, concealed his anger against Herod, keeping it hidden, until he took his revenge after Gaius had succeeded to the rule of the Romans. At that time Philip, Herod's brother, died in the 20th year of Tiberius's reign, having himself governed Trachonitis, Gaulonitis, and the nation of the Batanians in addition for 37 years, and having shown himself moderate and unconcerned with trouble in his rule. He spent his whole life in the territory subject to him, and when he made his rounds, he was accompanied by only a few chosen men, and had his throne, on which he used to sit in judgment, carried with him on the roads, so that whenever someone met him in need of assistance, there was no delay. The throne was set up on the spot, wherever it happened to be, and sitting there he heard the case at once, imposed penalties on the guilty, and released those unjustly caught up in accusations. He died at Julia's, and after his body was brought to the tomb which he himself had built earlier, a costly funeral was held. Since he left no children, Tiberius took over his rule and made it an addition to the province of Syria, though he ordered that the taxes collected in what had been his tetrarchy be kept apart and deposited there. At this time, a quarrel broke out between Aretas, king of Petra, and Herod, for the following reason. Herod the Tetrarch had married the daughter of Aretas and had lived with her for a long time already. Setting out for Rome, he lodged with Herod, his brother by a different mother, for this Herod was the son of the daughter of Simon the high priest. There he fell in love with Herodias, the wife of this brother. She was the daughter of Aristobulus, who was also their brother, and sister of Agrippa the Great, and Herod ventured to speak with her of marriage. She accepted, and an agreement was made that she would move in with him once he returned from Rome. Part of the agreement was that he would put away the daughter of Aretas. Having made these arrangements, he sailed for Rome. But when he was returning, having accomplished in Rome the business for which he had gone, his wife, having learned of the agreement with Herodias, before it became known to him that she knew everything, asked to be sent to Machaerus, which lies on the border between the territory of Aretas and that of Herod, without revealing her intention. Herod sent her off, not suspecting that the woman had perceived anything. She, however, had already sent word ahead to Machaerus, which was subject to her father, and with everything prepared for the journey by the governor, she arrived and at once set out for Arabia, passing from one governor's escort to the next in succession, and came to her father as quickly as possible and told him of Herod's intention. He took this as the beginning of hostility, which was joined also by a dispute over borders in the territory of Gamala. Each side gathered forces for war and appointed generals to command in their place, and when the battle took place, Herod's entire army was destroyed, betrayed by men who were deserters from Philip's tetrarchy and had campaigned alongside Herod. Herod wrote of this to Tiberius, who, angered at Aretas's aggression, wrote to Vitellius to make war on him and either bring him back alive in chains or, if he were killed, send his head to him. This is what Tiberius directed the governor of Syria to do. Some of the Jews thought that the destruction of Herod's army came from God, and quite justly, in punishment for what he had done to John, called the Baptist. For Herod had put him to death, though he was a good man, one who urged the Jews to practice virtue, to act with justice toward one another and with piety toward God, and so to come together in baptism. For only in this way, he taught, would the baptism itself appear acceptable to God, not as employed to beg pardon for certain sins, but as a purification of the body, seeing that the soul too had already been thoroughly cleansed beforehand by righteousness. When others too began to gather around him, since they were extremely stirred by the hearing of his words, Herod grew afraid that persuasion of this degree over men might lead to some uprising, since they seemed likely to do everything on his advice, and thought it far better to act first and put him to death, before any change came about through him, than to fall into difficulties and then have to regret it once the revolt had actually happened. So John, a prisoner sent to Machaerus, the fortress mentioned above, on suspicion born of Herod, was put to death there. The Jews believed that the destruction of the army came about as vengeance on Herod's behalf, God wishing to do him harm. Vitellius, having prepared for the war against Aretas with two legions of heavy infantry, along with their light troops and cavalry drawn as allies from the kingdom subject to Rome, hastened toward Petra and reached Ptolemais. As he was setting out to lead the army through Judea, the leading men met him and asked that he not take that route through their country, for it was not their ancestral custom to permit standards to be carried through it, since many images were mounted on them. Persuaded, he changed the plan he had previously formed on this point, and ordering the army to march through the Great Plain, he himself went up to Jerusalem with Herod the Tetrarch and his friends to sacrifice to God, since a festival of the ancestral kind for the Jews was then in progress. There he was met and received magnificently by the multitude of the Jews, and spent 3 days in the city. During this time, he removed Jonathan from the high priesthood and handed it over to his brother Theophilus. On the fourth day, letters arrived informing him of the death of Tiberius, and he made the people swear allegiance to Gaius. He also recalled the army to its several winter quarters, no longer being able to press the war in the same way, since affairs had now passed into the hands of Gaius. It was also said that Aretas, on receiving report of Vitellius's soldiers, consulted the omens and declared that it was not possible for the army to make its way against Petra, for one of the leaders would die, either the one who had ordered the war, or the one who had set out to carry out his intention, or the one against whom the expedition had been prepared. And so Vitellius withdrew to Antioch. Agrippa, the son of Aristobulus, went up to Rome a year before Tiberius's death to transact some business with the emperor, once he had come into possession of some means. I wish, then, to speak at greater length about Herod and his family, both because the account belongs to this history, and because it affords a demonstration of the divine, showing that neither numbers nor any other strength that men achieve avails anything apart from piety toward the divine, seeing that within 100 years of his death, but for a few, and there were many of them, Herod's descendants perished. This might also contribute something to the correction of the human race, to learn of their misfortune, and at the same time it allows the story of Agrippa to be told, a man most deserving of wonder, who from being an utterly private citizen, and beyond all expectation of those who knew him, rose to such a degree of power. I have spoken of these matters before, but I will now set them out again in precise detail. Herod the Great had 2 daughters by Mariam, the daughter of Hyrcanus. Salampsio, the one who was married to Phasael, her own cousin, son of Herod's brother Phasael, her father having given her to him, and Cypros, likewise married to her cousin Antipater, son of Herod's sister Salome. To Phasael, Salampsio bore 5 children, Antipater, Alexander, Herod, and daughters Alexandra and Cypros, whom Agrippa, son of Aristobulus, married. Alexandra was married to Timaeus of Cyprus, a man of distinction, and died childless in his house. To Cypros, by Agrippa, were born 2 sons and 3 daughters, Berenice, Mariam, and Drusilla, the sons being named Agrippa and Drusus, of whom Drusus died before reaching manhood. Their father Agrippa was raised together with his other brothers, Herod and Aristobulus and Berenice, and these were the children of Herod, son of the Great. Berenice was the daughter of Costobarus and Salome, Herod's sister. Aristobulus, when he died at his father's hand, left these as infants, along with his brother Alexander, as we have said before. Having grown to manhood, this Herod, brother of Agrippa, married Mariam, daughter of Olympias, daughter of King Herod, and of Joseph, son of Joseph, this Joseph being brother of King Herod, and he had by her a son, Aristobulus. The 3rd brother of Agrippa, Aristobulus, married Jotape, daughter of Sampsigeramus, king of Emesa, and a daughter was born to them who was deaf. Her name too was Jotape. These, then, were the children of the male line. Herodias, their sister, was married to Herod, a son of Herod the Great by Mariam, daughter of Simon the high priest, and they had a daughter, Salome. After her birth, Herodias, resolving upon a confusion of ancestral custom, left her husband while he was still alive and married Herod, his brother by the same father, who held the Tetrarchy of Galilee. Her daughter Salome was married to Philip, son of Herod the Tetrarch of Trachonitis, and when he died childless, Aristobulus, son of Herod, Agrippa's brother, married her. 3 sons were born to them, Herod, Agrippa, and Aristobulus. This, then, is the line of Phasael and Salampsio. To Cypros, by Antipater, a daughter was born, Cypros, whom Alexas, son of Elshas, the son of Alexas, married, and her daughter, too, was named Cypros. Herod and Alexander, whom I said were Antipater's brothers, died childless. To Alexander, Herod the king's son, who was put to death by his father, sons were born, Alexander and Tigranes, by the daughter of Archelaus, king of Cappadocia. Tigranes, who became king of Armenia, died childless after being accused before the Romans. Alexander, his namesake and Tigranes' brother, had a son who became king of Armenia under Nero, and he too had a son, Alexander. This Alexander married Jotape, daughter of Antiochus, king of Comagene, and Vespasian set him up as king over a part of Cilicia. The line of Alexander, as soon as it was born, abandoned the observances proper to the Jews and went over to Greek custom, while it fell to the remaining daughters of King Herod to die childless. Of the descendants of Herod whom I have listed, those who remained were still living when, at the time when Agrippa the Great took over the kingdom. Now that I have set out the family in advance, I will go on to relate all the turns of fortune that came Agrippa's way, and how, after escaping them, he rose to the very height of both rank and power. A little before King Herod's death, Agrippa was living in Rome. He had grown up alongside Drusus, the son of the emperor Tiberius, and through their close familiarity and long companionship, he had also won the friendship of Antonia, the wife of Drusus the Elder, since Berenice, Agrippa's mother, was held in honor by her and had asked her to advance her son. Agrippa was naturally inclined to grandeur and lavish in his giving. While his mother was alive, he did not reveal what his heart wanted, since he thought it right to escape her anger at such things. But once Berenice died, he gave free rein to his own temperament. He spent his money partly on the extravagance of his daily living and partly on gifts given without measure, and the greatest part of it went to Caesar's freedmen, in hope of what their influence might do for him, so that in a short time he was reduced to poverty. This was what kept him from living any longer in Rome. Tiberius, moreover, since his son had died, had forbidden his son's friends to come into his sight, because seeing them stirred up his grief by reminding him of the boy. For these reasons, then, Agrippa set sail for Judea, in low spirits and humbled, having lost his fortune and having no way to pay off his debts to his many creditors, who allowed him no relief whatsoever. So, at a loss what to do and ashamed before them, he withdrew to a certain tower at Malatha in Idumea, where he was of a mind to end his own life. His wife Cypros perceived his intention and did everything she could to turn him from such plans. She also sent letters to his sister Herodias, who was living with Herod the Tetrarch, explaining the straits Agrippa had fallen into and the necessity that had driven him to such a plan, and asking her, as a kinswoman, to look on and help, showing in every way how she might relieve her husband, especially since their circumstances had once been so similar. Herod and Herodias sent for him, appointed Tiberias as his residence, granted him a sum of money for his upkeep, and honored him with the market inspectorship of Tiberias. Herod, however, did not long abide by these arrangements, insufficient as they already were. At a drinking party in Tyre, words were exchanged between them under the influence of wine, and Agrippa, unable to bear it after Herod had reproached him with his poverty and with having to be given the necessities of life, went to Flaccus, the man of consular rank, who had earlier been a particular friend of his in Rome and who was at that time governing Syria. Flaccus received him, and Agrippa was staying with him there, along with Aristobulus, who, although Agrippa's brother, was at odds with him. Their mutual enmity did no harm to either, so that the ordinary marks of the consular's friendship were shown to both alike. Aristobulus, however, did not relax his hostility toward Agrippa in the least, and eventually brought him into conflict with Flaccus as well, taking as his occasion for this ill will the following affair. The people of Damascus were at odds with those of Sidon over a boundary dispute, and when Flaccus was about to hear the case, they learned that Agrippa carried great weight with him and asked that some part of their cause be entrusted to him, promising him a very large sum of money for it. He, for his part, set about doing everything he could to help the Damascenes. But Aristobulus, since the agreement about the money had not escaped his notice, denounced him to Flaccus. When the matter was investigated and found to be true, Flaccus drove Agrippa from his friendship. Reduced to the utmost want, Agrippa came to Ptolemais, and since he had no means of living anywhere else, he resolved to sail for Italy. But being shut out by lack of funds, he asked Marcius, his own freedman, to raise money for such purposes for him by borrowing from someone. Marcius accordingly asked Peter, a freedman of Berenice, Agrippa's mother, who by the terms of her will was under obligation to Antonia, to advance the sum himself on a note of hand and his own credit. Peter, since he had a claim against Agrippa for money owed him, forced Marcius to draw up a bond for 20,000 Attic drachmas, taking 2,500 less than that amount. Marcius agreed to this, since there was no other way to manage it. Once this sum had been secured, Agrippa went to Anthedon, took ship, and was on the point of putting to sea. But Hirnius Capito, the procurator of Jamnia, learning of it, sent soldiers to collect from him 300,000 drachmas of silver owed to Caesar's treasury from his time in Rome and pressed him to stay. Agrippa at the time pretended he would comply with the order, but when night came, he cut his moorings and made for Alexandria, sailing on. There he asked Alexander the Alabag to lend him 200,000 drachmas. Alexander said he would not give it to him, but he did not refuse Cypros, being struck by her devotion to her husband and by all her other virtues besides. She gave her pledge, and Alexander, having given them 5 talents at Alexandria, promised to provide the rest once they reached Puteoli, being wary of how ready Agrippa was to spend. So Cypros, having set her husband on his way to Italy, herself returned with the children to Judea. Agrippa, putting in at Puteoli, wrote a letter to Tiberius Caesar, who was residing at Capri, announcing his arrival and asking to pay his respects and see him, and requesting permission to cross over to Capri. Tiberius, without any hesitation, wrote back to him in the most gracious terms, and when Agrippa duly arrived at Capri, showing nothing lacking in the warmth of his letter, he welcomed him and entertained him. But the next day a letter reached Caesar from Hirnius Capito, stating that Agrippa, having taken a loan of 300,000 drachmas and let the agreed time for repayment lapse, had fled the province the moment repayment was demanded, thereby putting himself beyond his power to collect it. Reading this letter, Caesar was greatly displeased and ordered that Agrippa be barred from his presence until he had paid the debt. Agrippa, not in the least daunted by Caesar's anger, appealed to Antonia, mother of Germanicus and of Claudius, who later became Caesar, asking her to lend him the 300,000 drachmas so that he might not forfeit his friendship with Tiberius. She, remembering his mother Berenice, for the two women had been very close to each other, and because of the intimacy that had grown up between Agrippa and Claudius's circle, gave him the money, and once he had paid off the debt, his friendship with Tiberius stood unimpeded. Tiberius Caesar afterward assigned him to his grandson, instructing him to accompany the boy on all his outings. Agrippa, received into Antonia's friendship, then turned his attentions to Gaius, who was her grandson and, out of regard for his father, held in the highest honor. There was also another man, a Samaritan by birth, a freedman of Caesar's. From him, Agrippa raised a loan of 1,000,000 drachmas, with which he repaid the debt owed to Antonia, and with the rest, spent in courting Gaius, he rose all the higher in his esteem. As Agrippa's friendship with Gaius grew to great importance, the two of them, talking together one day, fell into conversation about Tiberius. And Agrippa, turning the talk into a wish since they were alone together, said he prayed that Tiberius, the old man, might soon step down from power and hand it over to Gaius, who was in every way more worthy of it, for then Tiberius's own grandson would be no obstacle to them, since he would die at Gaius's hand. Eutychus, a freedman of Agrippa's and his charioteer, overheard these words and at the time kept silent about them. But afterward, accused by Agrippa of stealing some garments of his, and indeed he had truly stolen them, he fled, was caught, and was brought before Piso, who was the prefect of the city. When Piso asked the reason for his flight, he said he had secret words to speak to Caesar, bearing on Caesar's own safety, so Piso had him bound and sent to Capri. There Tiberius, true to his own character, kept him in chains, being as much given to delay as any king or tyrant who ever lived. He never gave prompt audience to embassies, nor was any successor appointed for governors or procurators he had sent out, unless they happened to die first. Hence he was equally indifferent about hearing the cases of prisoners. So when his friends asked him the reason for this way of dragging things out, he said that he put off embassies so that, once they had been given prompt dismissal, other envoys freshly appointed would come in their place, and he would be burdened with receiving and escorting them over and over again. And that he left governorships to those who had once been appointed to them, out of consideration for their subjects. For it is the nature of every position of authority to be inclined toward greed, and those that are not held permanently, but only briefly and uncertainly, until the moment they are taken away, only spur those who hold them on to plunder all the more. If then they remained in office longer, they would in time have their fill of plundering, since the sheer volume of what they had already gained would make them use their position more sluggishly thereafter. Whereas if a successor came quickly, those subject to greedy governors would never gain any relief, since the time allowed would not be enough for those already sated to relax their eagerness to take, precisely because they were removed before they had had their fill in due time. And he told them this story to illustrate the point. A wounded man lay with flies swarming in great numbers around his wounds. Someone who happened by, pitying his misfortune and supposing that he lacked the strength to help himself, came up and set about driving the flies away. When the wounded man asked him to stop doing this, the man was puzzled and asked him why he showed no concern to escape the evil that beset him. "You would do me a greater wrong," he said, "by driving them off. These flies here, now that they are already gorged with my blood, no longer press me so hard, but in a way even ease off. But if fresh ones came together, driven by unspent hunger, and found me already worn down, they would finish me off entirely." For this reason, he said, he himself, mindful that his subjects had already been ruined by so much plundering, thought it prudent not to keep sending out new governors one after another, who would harry them in the manner of these flies, since men naturally bent on gain, once they took office, would have as their ally the expectation that their pleasure in it would soon be taken away. Tiberius's own conduct will bear out what I say about his character in such matters. For in the 22 years he was emperor, he sent out only 2 men in all to govern the Jewish nation and administer its affairs, Gratus and Pilate, who succeeded him in the office. And he was not only such toward the Jews, but different toward the rest of his subjects as well. Even in the case of prisoners, he made plain how far his reluctance to give them a hearing went, in that for men condemned to death, execution would have brought relief from the evils pressing upon them, since it is not for any virtue of theirs that such a fate comes upon them by chance, while for those left to be worn down, the lingering weight upon them only made their misfortune the greater. It was for these reasons, then, that Eutychus too failed to obtain a hearing and remained bound in chains. But as time passed, Tiberius came from Capri to Tusculum, about 100 stadia from Rome, and Agrippa asked Antonia to arrange a hearing for Eutychus on the charges he was bringing against him. Antonia was held in the highest honor by Tiberius, both for the dignity of her kinship, for she was the wife of his brother Drusus, and for her virtue and self-restraint. For though still young when widowed, she remained so, and refused to marry another, even though Augustus himself had urged her to marry someone, and she kept her life free of scandal. She had also, in her own right, been of the greatest service to Tiberius personally. For when a great conspiracy was formed against him by Sejanus, a man who was both his friend and at that time held the greatest power, because he commanded the armies, and most of the Senate as well as many of the freedmen had gone over to him, and the soldiery had been corrupted, and the conspiracy was making great headway and might well have succeeded, had not Antonia met Sejanus's villainy with a boldness wiser than his cunning. For when she learned what had been contrived against Tiberius, she wrote to him setting out everything in detail and giving the letter to Pallas, the most trustworthy of her slaves, sent it off to Tiberius at Capri. He, on learning of it, put Sejanus and his fellow conspirators to death and held Antonia, whom even before he had regarded highly, in still greater honor thereafter, and trusted her in all things. It was at the urging of this same Antonia that Tiberius, though reluctant, agreed to examine Eutychus. "If Eutychus has spoken falsely," said Tiberius, "about what Agrippa is said to have said, he will receive from me punishment enough, which I myself have already imposed on him. But if, under torture, what he has said proves true, let Agrippa take care that in his eagerness to punish his freedman, he does not call down the trial on his own head instead." When Antonia reported this to him, Agrippa pressed all the more insistently for the matter to be examined, and Antonia, since Agrippa would not let up in his entreaties on this score, seized an occasion of the following kind. Tiberius was being carried along on a litter, with Gaius, her grandson, and Agrippa walking alongside. They had just come from lunch. Walking beside the litter, she urged that Eutychus be summoned and examined. Tiberius said, Antonia, let the gods be my witness that it is not of my own will, but drawn out by the necessity of your entreaty, that I do what I am about to do. So saying, he ordered Macro, who was Sejanus's successor, to bring Eutychus. He came without any delay. Tiberius asked him what he had to say against a man who had given him his freedom. Eutychus said, Master, Gaius here and Agrippa with him were riding along in a carriage, and I was sitting at their feet, and as much talk went round, Agrippa said to Gaius, If only the day would come when this old man stepped aside and appointed you ruler of the world. For then Tiberius, his grandson, would be no obstacle to us at all, since he would die at your hands, and the world would be blessed. And I along with Tiberius took what had been said as trustworthy, and it also recalled to him an old grudge against Agrippa. When he had ordered Agrippa to pay court to Tiberius his grandson, the son of Drusus, Agrippa had treated him with contempt, ignoring the summons and going over entirely to Gaius's side. This man, he said, Macro, put him in chains. Macro did not clearly understand whom he had been ordered to bind, and besides, he did not expect any such order to concern Agrippa, so he held back to make sure he had understood correctly. But when Caesar, having made a circuit of the hippodrome, found Agrippa standing there, he said, Macro, it is indeed this man I said should be bound. When Macro asked again which man, he said, Agrippa, of course. Agrippa turned to entreaty, invoking the memory of the boy with whom he had been raised and of Tiberius's own upbringing, but it did him no good at all. They led him off in his purple robes, a prisoner. The heat was fierce, and since he had not drunk much wine with his meal, thirst burned in him. His anguish was made worse by the indignity of it all. Seeing one of Gaius's slaves, a boy named Thaumastus, carrying water in a vessel, he asked to drink. When the boy readily held it out and Agrippa had drunk, he said, Boy, if this service of yours turns out well for you, once I am free of these chains, I will lose no time in securing your freedom from Gaius, since he showed no less regard for me now, a prisoner, than when I held my former rank. And he did not fail to make good on this word. Indeed, he repaid it more than in kind. For later, when he had become king, he had Thaumastus freed Gaius Caesar by then having granted this and set him over his estate. And when he died, in that same office of honor, an old man, he left him behind still in service to his son Agrippa and his daughter Berenice on the same terms. But that all belongs to a later time. Agrippa, then, stood there in chains before the palace, leaning against a tree out of despondency, along with many others who were likewise bound. A bird settled on the tree against which Agrippa was leaning. The Romans call this bird an owl, and one of the prisoners, a German, saw it and asked the soldier who the man in the purple robe was. On learning that his name was Agrippa, that he was a Jew by birth, and one of the most eminent men of that nation, he asked the soldier chained beside him if he might come near and speak with him, saying he wished to ask him something concerning his ancestral customs. Given leave, he came close and through an interpreter said, Young man, the suddenness of this change that has come upon you, bringing with it so great and abrupt a reversal of fortune, no doubt shakes you, and you distrust any words that promise deliverance from the trouble now upon you, thinking them to deny the workings of divine providence. But know this, by the gods of my own fathers and the gods native to this place who have set this iron upon us, I swear I will tell you everything, giving no license to an idle, glib tongue, nor seeking merely to cheer you with empty words. For predictions of this kind, when the event that should confirm them is delayed, only add a harsher grief than if one had never heard them at all. Still, I judge it right, even at risk to myself, to disclose to you the gods' foretelling. There is no way that you will not be released from these bonds very soon, and advance to the very height of rank and power. You will become the envy of all who now pity your misfortune, and you will make a happy end for the children you will leave behind you in life. But remember, when you next see this bird, that your death will follow 5 days after. This will come to pass exactly as this bird, sent forth by God, signifies. I did not think it right to withhold from you the understanding that has come to me by foreknowledge of these things, so that, knowing that good is to come, you might set the grief of your present state at a lighter weight. And remember, once the good fortune has come into your hands, the misfortune we now share together as well, so that you may free me from it. So much did the German foretell, and he earned from Agrippa such laughter at the time as, by later events, proved him worthy of wonder instead. Antonia, distressed at Agrippa's misfortune, saw that speaking to Tiberius about him would be a difficult matter and in any case likely to come to nothing. But she did secure from Macro that a moderate number of soldiers be assigned to watch over him with care, and a centurion to be set over them and to share his confinement, that he be allowed a daily bath, and visits from his freedmen and friends, and every other comfort that could be given his body. So his friend Silas and his freedmen Marcius and Stoicus came into him, bringing food he enjoyed and attending to him with every care, and bringing garments too, under pretense of selling them, which at nightfall, with the soldiers' connivance, Macro having arranged it beforehand, they spread beneath him. This went on for 6 months. Such was Agrippa's situation. Meanwhile, Tiberius, having returned to Capri, fell ill, at first only moderately. But as the sickness grew worse and he had little hope for himself, he summoned Euodus, who was most honored among his freedmen, and ordered him to bring the children to him, for he wished to speak with them before he died. He had no legitimate children left of his own. Drusus, his only son, had died. But Drusus had left a son, Tiberius, called Gemellus, and there was also Gaius, son of Germanicus, his brother's son, already a young man who had completed his education to the fullest, and who was honored by the good will of the people on account of the virtue of his father Germanicus. For Germanicus had risen to the very greatest honor among the common people, through the steadiness of his character and his graciousness in dealing with others, being unassuming and winning esteem by his wish to be equal to all.